classes for the public. I do a lot of food safety, food preservation, and we're going to delve into that a bit today. I also do some different cooking classes, some health and nutrition like diabetes education, some mental health classes for the general public, and then lots of things with youth, both 4-H and then going into the schools and doing lots of different programming and overseeing our 4-H Friday Friends program in Bonners Ferry. So there's never a dull moment in Extension. It's always lots of fun. As far as my history, I have grown up in Bonner Boundary County my entire life, living on a farm and ranch myself as a child, and then now up in Paradise Valley with my husband. And I've been in the garden probably since I could walk. And so this is definitely one of my favorite topics to talk about, and thinking about all the work I still have to do in my garden. That it's as hot as you're talking about it being. I know summer's coming to an end soon, and we need to be getting things kind of wrapped up.
It sounds like you are kind of mentally in your garden, Amy, even at work.
Yes.
You're mentally thinking about, how am I going to save this harvest? How am I going to do that?
Oh, for sure.
Yes. And your job is different than Jen's job. You are the safety, food safety educator.
Yes.
That's
yes.
Right. That's why we have you here today. Thanks for coming down from Bonners.
Thanks for having me.
And also Susie Miller. Susie Miller, now this is interesting. She's a master food safety advisor. Now Susie lives in Sandpoint, but give us a minute, Susie, and introduce yourself and tell us why. Why are you a master advisor? And I assume Amy trained you.
Yes.
Okay.
And so I, my degree way back when was in food science.
Okay.
And when I first came to Bonners Ferry, it was actually Amy's aunt that I trained under in 1992.
Oh, gosh.
Which is kind of crazy. And we had a great program back then. And then the program kind of died. And so gratefully, Amy brought it back again. And I love the science of food. I love just what you can do with it and how you can change it to store and preserve later on. And yes, I do have a little farm. I have goats and sheep and alpacas and a huge garden. And yeah, I like to be able to do things with it.
Well, thanks for being here with us. It's nice to have you. So let's delve into this saving the harvest idea. The first concern is getting it out of the garden. Let's talk a little bit about how you pick, how you tell if it's ripe, what you can pick green and let ripen, what you have to let ripen before you pick, and all those quick little things that you might have in mind. Go ahead, Amy.
Yes, so it is going to depend a little bit on each type of crop that you are growing, which type of produce. In your garden, most things you're going to want to wait till it's fully ripe to pick. Tomatoes is one of those main exceptions that you can pick those green tomatoes and let them ripen. I know in the fall, it seems like I always have several boxes of green tomatoes that ripen throughout October because I just don't want to let them all die when that frost comes. But in most other cases, there's a few vegetables you can pick slightly underripe, but really it's best to pick them at their peak ripeness. And that's going to depend a little bit on each type of produce. So I really recommend that you find some good resources so you know when is best to harvest those different items. For most anything, though, if you can harvest it in the morning, you're going to have your best results rather than waiting till it's drier and getting hot. So when it's that nice cool temperature in the morning, that's your best time to harvest. And then either getting it into a refrigerator or a storage place as soon as possible, or straight into one of those food preservation methods that we'll be discussing later on.
Get it cooled off right away.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What if you don't and it gets wilty? Is there a way to revive some produce before you process it that you've waited too long to process? Can you soak it in ice water? Can you salt? No, it's too late. If it gets limp, it's all over.
Yeah, you can, if you're wanting to eat it fresh,
okay,
then you could soak it in like an ice water bath for 15 to 30 minutes. However, if you are wanting to preserve it, it can actually change the product too much by adding that extra water to it. So you don't want to plump it up if you're going to preserve it.
I'm already learning things, folks. This is such an interesting topic to me. So let's get into saving the harvest, starting with canning. Now, water bath, is that easiest for beginners as far as canning?
I think in most cases, water bath or boiling water, I use those two terms interchangeably. So if you hear one or the other, I'm talking about the same thing. I think a lot of people like to start with that because with pressure canning, there's a lot of fear. Just because we hear stories and we see, you know, photos, especially on the internet, social media, we see all sorts of horror stories where if you're doing everything safely, that's not going to happen. It's something, you know, someone was very negligent, really, if something, you know, horrific is going to happen with your pressure canner. But water bath canning, a lot of people do like it because it's much shorter time. Your processing time, once that water is boiling, you know, is a lot shorter. There's a lot more variety to your recipes. We know that's going to be our jams and jellies, salsas, a lot of other products that I might consider our fun products. Pressure canning is great too, but that is, if someone is just getting started, I really do recommend boiling water canning. How about you, Susie?
I agree on that. Pressure canning, there's a ton of fear involved with pressure canning, and there's rules that we need to follow in both, but pressure canning, you really have to follow the rules.
Yes, and some of those wives' tales are really old. I mean, they're your aunt or your great aunt or your grandmother that the lid blew off. It seems like, especially because the extension office, don't you test pressure canners for people?
Yes, if you have a dial gauge canner, then we recommend you get it tested every year. If you are canning year-round, I'd recommend twice a year.
Okay.
Although one nice thing with our canners today is they have some different safety features that, you know, grandma's canner 100 years ago didn't have. So if you do have grandma's canner, I do encourage you, bring it in, let us check it. Make sure if it doesn't have some safety features, some can be adjusted, some... I have my grandma's old canner, and it's a planter on my patio because that's the only safe way I can use it. So definitely take it into the extension office, get that gauge tested. And even if you're buying a brand new canner, don't assume that it's safe. We test brand new gauges all the time that are off by enough. If it's off by more than 2 pounds of pressure, it needs to get replaced. But just the gauge, not the whole canner.
Right, right.
Well, because you have to remember those gauges are super sensitive and they get bumped in packaging, just how you store it, all those factors taken. You have to take into consideration.
Not hard to imagine it being damaged. What about Instapots?
They're electric cookers.
Okay.
They're not canners.
Okay.
Big difference.
Okay. Not as much pressure, I assume. Or not consistent pressure.
Well, and if you look at a pressure canner has 5, 10, and 15 pounds of pressure. And they have little weights that you put on so that you know you're getting that weight in your canner so that it gets to the right temperature. But in an Instapot or a pressure cooker, you don't know the pressure inside.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes,
it's
absolutely.
Usually geared more toward the 5 pounds of pressure.
Yes, so to safely can most anything at our elevation, it's if you have a weighted gauge canner, it's 15 pounds of pressure, a dial gauge, it's 12. Most electric pressure cookers, they vary between 9 to 11 pounds, but it's not consistent. The venting process is different. There's so many other safety factors that are not accounted for. So electric pressure cookers, they are a great tool for cooking. I even teach a class on how to cook with them. It's lots of fun. But for canning, you've got to use your stovetop canner.
What about some favorite recipes of canning or either water canning or pressure canning that you might want to share? Or not the recipe, but just what you've done that has really tickled you.
I love all the different jams and jellies. I like to get creative and give them as presents. Although one thing I really like to do is rhubarb sauce.
Ooh.
It seems like that's one of those things that we're, you know, seem to get a lot of around here. And just canning some simple rhubarb sauce and then throwing it on yogurt or ice cream or as part of a dessert, you can't go wrong.
And Susie?
My favorite is also jams. Because like Amy, you can experiment with your different flavors and you can combine huckleberry with blueberry or raspberry and blackberry, or you can have all the berries mixed together, which that happened by chance because I had a cup of this, a cup of that, a cup of that, and I had a triple berry jam, and it was one of our favorites. So you can play with that. I also like making applesauce.
Applesauce. Yum.
Well, and Amy has an awesome tree because she ends up with pink applesauce.
Ooh. Yeah. That's neat. Let's talk about apples. You were just telling me something that's new about apples.
So, yes, they have done some research, mainly Ball, which I'm sure if you've canned, you've heard of Ball. So they did quite a bit of research about a year and a half ago is when they were really working on it. And they have found out that our apple varieties are not as acidic as they used to be. So they're kind of going the way of the tomato a little bit. And while we're not necessarily saying that all apples aren't very acidic, just the variation between varieties and then also how long we store apples, that acidity level changes. So when you are picking your apple off your tree, you know it's fresh. But if you're buying a box of apples or you're getting apples at the store, that box, those apples could be 2, 3, 4 months old. And the longer they sit, the lower that acidity is going to be. And so it's really unknown what that acidity level of the apples are. So they now have recommendations that pretty much every recipe for canning that includes apples, you're going to be adding some lemon juice. And it's really not enough that's going to be changing that flavor. They have, you know, revamped. They've thoroughly tested all the recipes. There was one recipe that they just couldn't get to work. It was an apple maple jam or something. I can't remember now what it was. There was one that they just could not make it safe and still taste good. But otherwise, all their stuff. So if you're making applesauce, make sure that you're adding just that little bit of lemon juice. Although a lot of people like to add some lemon juice anyways for the color.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really not much more than what you were adding for that.
Right, right. And how do you store your canned products? Is there a safe way to do that?
There is a safe way. They need to be stored in a cool, dry, dark place. And you also have to remember, too, that, you know, you have a two-part sealing system. You have the seal and then you have the ring. So after your jars are sealed and you wait your 24 hours, you can take the ring off. But so you don't store your canned products with the ring on. And that sometimes people think, oh, if I keep the ring on, they're going to last longer and the seal won't pop. But that's not entirely true. You have a better seal and you know that it stays sealed when the ring's not on.
And
you don't stack them. You don't put one. No.
Big no-no.
No, don't stack on top of it. Well, because you're adding pressure to the seal.
Sure.
So, yeah, so don't stack your jars.
That's a real newbie mistake, not taking the ring off, because mm-hmm. I've had rust, and, you know, at first, it was just kind of a bad idea to store, but it's for seal, too.
It is, and sometimes juices seep out after, you know, as they're cooling, which is, you know, the steam comes out, and then the seal, it seals it, and so sometimes you get things on your rim, and so you need to clean it off, and if you have a ring on it, you can't clean it off.
Right. Let's move on to vinegars. Does the type of vinegar you use for pickling matter?
Yes.
Okay.
Big time it matters. And so right now our vinegar is 5%. And so we need to follow recipes per that. And some families want to use their great grandma's recipes and they have to be real careful. We're not telling them not to use the recipe, but when your great grandma canned, their vinegar could have been 12 or 10 or 7%. And so if you realize that you're adding water to the vinegar to dilute it, if you start off with a 10%, you're going to add so much water. But most people don't bother to check and know that vinegar has changed. And so we use 5% now. And recipes in the Ball book and USDA will account for that.
They recommend, or they assume you're using 5%, and that's what the recipe
reads. Well, that's
reads.
What's out there right now,
right.
Is the 5% vinegar.
Okay.
But they did, but it has been known to change.
That's why we need
That's why.
Update our
And they don't often tell you, so you have to read.
Yes.
I when it was 7 and went to 5, I just assumed that it was still 7% vinegar, and it wasn't.
Okay.
So don't assume.
And there's some vinegars on your store shelves now that are 4%.
That's right.
So when you go to the grocery store, if you're buying vinegar specifically for pickling foods, you need to check the label and make sure it is 5%.
That's so interesting. Canning salt versus table salt. What's the difference there?
Okay, so canning salt doesn't have the anti-caking agents, and it doesn't have iodine. And so table salt will usually have iodine in the anti-caking agents. And so you just want pure salt. Just use canning salt.
Okay, that's a must. Mm-hmm. No exceptions.
No exceptions. Yeah.
And what about when you're making a pickled recipe for the table, like pickled cucumbers or something? Should you be using canning salt for that too? Does it matter?
Well, iodine kind of can give an off flavor. Okay. So try to use things that don't have iodine in your pickling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It will add a flavor.
Yeah, and it can also cause a cloudiness, either the iodine or the anti-caking. And when you're looking at your jar of pickled products, if it looks kind of cloudy, you're not gonna know, was it my salt or is there bacteria? Is there spoilage in my jar? So that's another huge reason to always use the canning and pickling salt, is to make sure that you are doing everything you can to make sure that there's not a question, is it the salt, is it bacteria, what's going on with my jar?
Hmm. Do you water bath your pickles after you've made them?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Not pressure can, water bath.
Right.
Correct. Yes. Okay. Any favorite recipes, favorite pickling recipes?
The pickled carrots, the ginger carrots.
Ooh.
Remember we did that in class? Wasn't it pickled ginger carrots?
They're not pickled. Those are pressure cans.
Oh, those are, never mind, lied.
Oh, pressure can.
But there's some really good honey ginger carrots that you can pressure can.
They're really good. Oh, they're pressure can carrots. Sorry, they're not pickled.
Yum, that does sound good.
I think one of my favorite pickled recipes is corn relish. That has corn and like peppers and celery and onions and...
Cucumbers?
There's no cucumbers.
Oh, man, I have so many cucumbers. and I was telling you about my fruit vinegar, what had happened to it, and I realized that there was nothing wrong with it. I opened the lid of my fruit vinegar, and it looked like a plastic cover over it, like a seal. And I was so worried, what is that? Where'd that come from? Susie, tell us what that is.
It's called a mother, and it's as it ferments, it creates the seal. And so all I can't really call it bad bacteria, but it's the fermentation process. And it just creates this amazing fungus. Is it a fungus?
I think
mold? Yeah.
I think it's a fungus.
Don't quote me on that.
Fermented?
Well, anyway, yeah, so it creates this amazing thing of all sorts of good bacteria on top of it. And it's pretty cool how it does that.
That's amazing. I hadn't made fruit vinegars in so long, I didn't remember that.
Yeah, and so if you buy vinegar in the store, you'll see a mother in it.
Yes.
But it's the good stuff.
All right, since we talked about pickling, let's go to fermentation. Do you do any fermented food, like the pickling without the vinegar and let it sit?
That's when you really need Joan.
Yeah.
We have one lady who's just specializes in fermenting, and so... I do a lot of vinegars, and so I have two ways that I do my apple cider vinegar. I do it with just plain old apple cider that I've pressed, and I tend to add a little start from an old vinegar so that I make sure that I have the good bacteria in it. Some people don't do anything at all, which is totally fine. You take paper towels. I like to use my milk filters. Some people use coffee filters, and you put it on, put your ring on, and then you take a lid and you don't seal it. You just kind of let it sit, and you put it in a cool, dark spot and let it do its magic for a couple weeks.
Wow.
So that's one way. Another way is to take all your old apple cores, your apple peels, all those, and you stuff them in a jar and then pour. Now, this is important that you use distilled vinegar, not your tap water, because there's other things in our water. So you need to have a pure water. And you fill it up and do the same thing.
You put the distilled water in with all the
methanol, and you fill in all the gaps.
Wow.
And if you watch, you'll see these little bubble things start to happen, and all these little things start to eat each other, and it's pretty amazing.
That's cool.
Lots of fermenting. So that's your favorite recipe. How about drying? Fruits, vegetables, leathers. Is any pre-treating necessary for drying?
So yes and no. Although one thing I wanted to add before we jumped into drying on vinegars, while it's great to make your own vinegars at home, just know those are only used for cooking.
Yes.
You can never use your homemade vinegar in canning.
Oh.
Because it's not that verified 5% acid. And people ask, well, can I, you know, pH test my vinegar and things like that? It's not the same. It's not as accurate. So while it is great to make your homemade vinegars and use them in your home cooking recipes, they're not safe for canning.
Okay. Do you use apple cider vinegar for pickling?
Well, if you're pickling.
Or canning is what you're referring
to. Well, pick any type of food preservation.
Okay.
You have to use the
5%.
Okay. Vinegar.
And apple cider vinegar has a different flavor than the white vinegar, so most people don't want to use apple cider vinegar.
Yes, I've tried it, and I it was too much.
It is too much. And plus, you do have to make sure that you have the right acidity.
Sure.
Yeah, so most of your recipes are going to tell you which type of vinegar. And if you do want to change the flavor, you can change the type of vinegar. Just beware the end product might not be exactly what you want it to be you're changing up your vinegars.
That 5%, that is key.
It is.
Okay, now drying.
Yes, drying.
Pre-treat, yes, no?
It depends. So for vegetables, you need to blanch. That's a mandatory. You want to steam or boiling water blanch your vegetables before you dry them. It's going to have that best result. And then for fruits, it kind of depends on what you're doing. If you have a lighter colored fruit, then sometimes you might want to do some different pre-treatments to help with color. Pre-treatment is going to help with some of that retention with your heat-sensitive vitamins, because anytime you are drying your fruits and vegetables, you're going to lose some of those heat-sensitive vitamins. Everything else stays the same. Although in most cases for me, my fruits, when we dry them, they get eaten by my family so fast that if I was really thinking I'm going to have this for 6 months, I probably would pre-treat more of my fruits. But I know unless I hide them, they're going to be gone in a couple weeks.
Well, and it's more for looks, because like pears and apples will stay whiter if you pre-treat them. But if you don't care, then it doesn't matter.
So it's just for looks.
It really is. I mean, there is a little bit of nutrition, but mostly it's for looks.
Is pre-treating, is it like just sprinkling over it, or do you soak it?
It's usually a dip.
It's a dip. So it is somewhat soaked.
Mm-hmm.
Or just dipped, not
it's
soaked.
Just dipped, not soaked.
Because you don't want to make it any wetter than... Can you over-dry? Is it possible to over-dry?
You can over-dry until it's really, really crispy and really, really dark. And most people don't want to eat that. There is a happy little balance in there. So,
but yes, you can over-dry. And it's still... You can still eat it. But you might need to end up changing how you're planning to use it if it does get excessively dry. I always, say... When you test it, you want to pull it off your tray, let it cool down, and then you can kind of test it. You do want your fruits and vegetables, in most cases, to still be a little bit pliable, but definitely you don't want any moisture left. And then if you're new to drying, or if it's something you haven't dried before, I always recommend that you condition your fruits and vegetables. And for that, once you think it's dried, you put it in a large container with a lid, fill it half to two-thirds full, and just set it on your counter, and then shake it or stir it every day. Kind of pull up the lid, check it, make sure there's no condensation or moisture. And as long as you go about a week or so and you don't see any signs of moisture, then you can package it and store it. But if you do see any hints of moisture, then you can throw it back on your dehydrator for, an hour or two. And that's the best way to make sure it's not getting over dry, but still making sure that it's going to be safe and you're not going to package your bananas and come back in 3 weeks and have them be full of mold.
Right. Pasteurization, that I have that in one of my drying books, that when you're done, you put it in the oven at 160 degrees for 20 minutes. No, yes. Is that an old?
You can.
You can. You can, but you don't usually need to pasteurize your fruits and vegetables. So that's not a high safety thing. And pasteurization kind of to me is more like conditioning. If you look at the
same
process,
idea.
It's the same idea.
Sure. I like the container with the lid on it. And then you really do see if there is any moisture.
And with pasteurization, you're just trying to get it to a temperature for a certain period of time.
Right.
Yes. I would really only encourage someone to pasteurize it if they were concerned that maybe, you know, a window was open while they were drying and they're afraid that something got in on their fruits or vegetables.
Okay. Something.
But yeah, or if they just want that extra... extra bit of safety, mm-hmm. but like Susie said, in most cases, pasteurization isn't necessary.
Okay. How do you store your dried fruit and vegetables?
The same way that you store your other
just
products.
In a cupboard, not in the freezer?
No, you don't have to store them in the freezer if you've done it correctly and you try to get the oxygen out. Like if you put it in a jar and you have one of those vacuum sealers, that helps get the oxygen out. Some people use oxygen absorbers. You can just put it in a plastic bag or a jar and store it on yourself. But just note, you need to be able to keep the oxygen out and your shelf life won't be as long. Mm-hmm. But like Amy said, they usually go really quick.
Yes.
So.
Yes, they do. Or one of those Sealamils or
yeah, something like that. Something like that works.
Sure. Any favorite drying recipes?
I make a ton of fruit leather.
Ooh.
A ton. Even like, my granddaughter reminded me, school started, Grandma, I need fruit leather so I can put it in my lunches. And so yellow plums are on right now. And so that's what I'm doing today are my yellow plums to get them ready. I'll make some leather, but I also will can some so I can make it throughout the year. And so for me, my favorite recipe for fruit leather is pretty much 50-50 applesauce and whatever fruit I have. And then over the years, after taking and doing recertification with Amy, I add rhubarb. It just, the pectin in it makes it a tad tartar because you know how some applesauces are sweeter than others. And depending on their fruit, I don't use sugar in my fruit leather.
And are you cooking it down?
Nope. I just blend it all together. Blend it all together and put it on my drying trays, my fruit leather trays, and then dry it.
You're making me hungry.
It is probably the favorite thing.
That's great. So I need to break in real quick. This is 88.5 KRFY, and thanks for listening, everyone. I've got Amy Robertson here and Susie Miller talking about saving the harvest, and we got so much to talk about. But next, let's talk about freeze drying. What the heck is that? That's the new rage, huh?
Yes, it is.
My favorite.
Yes, Susie and I
have. Eyes lit up.
Yes, freeze drying is definitely something that Susie and I actually co-teach. And we have a class coming up here in Sandpoint.
Yay!
In October. I want to say the 22nd, but check our newsletter just in case I'm giving you the wrong date. But it will be here at the Sandpoint Organic Agriculture Center.
Awesome.
They just got a freeze dryer. But I've had a freeze dryer in my office since 2019. So right when they were really starting to hit the market is when I was able to get one. And because a lot of people don't know about it, I've taught a lot of classes, both in person and virtually and all over the nation. I've had other states invite me to teach to them because they don't know that much about it yet. And what's great about freeze drying is you can do almost anything. And when I say almost anything, there are a few foods like really high sugar, really high fat. So like chocolate, butter, jams and jellies, oils, some of those things aren't going to freeze dry very well.
Bread
can freeze dry okay, but then rehydrating.
It doesn't work.
French toast maybe.
Yeah, turning it into, you're just going to have a soggy mess for some of those things.
Of course.
So freeze drying is great that you do have to have a specialized appliance. Which they are a little expensive depending on if you're getting, you know, a small all the way up to an extra large. So we're talking $2,000 to $6,000 depending on what you choose to go for. There's a couple different brands out there that Susie and I have both done a lot with, Harvest Right and then Blue Alpine, that's made here in Idaho.
Oh,
those are our two ones we're the most familiar with. There's a few more just kind of starting to come out there that I don't know as much about, but they're coming. And so with freeze drying, you're going to follow a lot of the same steps as you would for dehydrating. As far as preparing some of your fruits and vegetables and other things, you do want to cut them into those nice uniform sizes to put them on your trays, because it comes with like stainless steel trays that you put your food on and you put it in your freeze dryer. But the process is much longer. If you can pre-freeze your food before you put it in the freeze dryer, it's going to shorten it a little bit. But in most cases, we're talking, you know, 20 to 36 hours for a batch for a freeze-dried food.
Whoa.
So it's a long time.
Yes. It truly is. And so if you look at freeze-drying, where it dehydrating, it's a slow heat and you're just pulling the moisture, you're pulling the moisture out. But it is a heat method. With freeze-drying, it freezes it at a very cold, cold temperature, like
-40,
yeah, which is crazy when you think about
yes.
it. And then all it's doing is removing the water molecules. So in drying, your food shrivels up. In freeze-drying, it stays the same. So a blueberry looks like a blueberry. It's just very crunchy. Whereas a blueberry that's dehydrated just shrivels up like a raisin.
Right. So and falls through the screen.
Yeah, so that is a different. There is difference in that. So if you, it's kind of funny when you compare like apples, freeze-drying apples and dehydrating apples. I can put more in a jar with my dehydrated apples than I can with my freeze-dried apples because they stay the same. The shape is the same.
Mm-hmm. I can see that.
Yeah. So storage space, definitely you have to allow a lot more.
Yes.
If you're freeze-drying.
Need more room.
But you can do so much more. And they rehydrate differently, where dehydrated food, it does rehydrate, but it still has that kind of cooked, dehydrated flavor.
Yes, the heat.
With freeze-drying, sometimes you can't even tell.
Oh, my gosh.
I can use freeze-dried berries in muffins and cookies, and people don't know that they were fresh, frozen, or freeze-dried.
So you don't have to hydrate them, or you do have to hydrate them before you use them in a recipe?
Nope,
no,
you don't. You don't.
Huh.
You might have to adjust how much moisture is in your recipe. If you're making muffins and cookies, you have to account for that. But mm-hmm. No, you don't have to.
Hmm. They're talking with dog food that's the new rage with dog food is dehydrated product.
Or freeze-drying.
Freeze-drying, yep. Yes. Because
it holds the nutrition.
Exactly. That heating up loses a lot.
So Amy has this, if I remember my figures right. So with loss of nutrients, with freeze-drying, you only lose maybe 3 to 7%. In freeze-drying, you hold the nutrients. But you have to remember, it's still fresh. I mean, it's still, if you put it in fresh, it's still fresh. If you put it in cooked, it's still cooked. Whereas dehydrating, it is cooked.
Yes.
A very low, low form of heat.
For sometimes a very, very long time.
And is dehydrating, they lose 40%?
Wow.
I don't have my chart in front of me. It's a lot compared.
Yes.
Yes. I want to say that dehydrating, and we're only talking about the heat sensitive vitamins.
Right.
Everything
right.
else stays the same regardless of your type of food preservation. So dehydrating, it's about 40%. Canning is up to 50 or 60%. Freezing, you don't lose much. But yeah, freeze drying, you only lose, 3 to 5%.
Wow, that is fascinating. I can see why a whole class would be necessary.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. But you have to look that a freeze drying does take a long time.
Yes.
So if you have a whole box of apples that need to be processed right away, you need to have other methods, not just freeze drying.
Are there a lot of trays in that freeze? Because it looks like an oven.
Oven. It depends on the size you get.
Oh.
If you have an
how much you can put in.
Right. It just depends.
Okay.
Yeah, most people get a medium for home use mm-hmm. or a large. So we're talking 4 to 6 trays.
Oh, gosh. It isn't that much.
So
it isn't
not,
like
it's
a dehydrator.
Not, no.
And think of depending on the size of your dehydrator, think of a cookie sheet because mm-hmm. the Blue Alpine really is a smaller cookie sheet.
Yeah, like the medium, it's a 9x13.
Mm-hmm.
So like my Blue Alpine has 5 trays that are 9x13. Whereas my Harvest Right, that's also a medium, it has 4 trays, but the trays are a little longer. So I fit about the same amount of produce on in the both machines.
I see.
So it just, but yeah, you can't, you just do one layer. You don't stack them really high. You don't want to have super huge chunks of food either, because that will really take a long time mm-hmm. for it to freeze dry. And then some other things that people need to consider if they are thinking about a freeze dryer, and that's why you need to take our class and you learn all sorts of good things. But beyond the initial cost of that machine, you are having to change out the oil ever so often and deal with that. But then also the electrical cost to use it, it can be up to a couple dollars per batch depending on your electrical bill and the size of your machine.
Wow.
And they are noisy as heck.
Oh.
So you don't want it necessarily in the main part of your house, because that machine will be on for your, say, 24 hours.
Yes.
So you need to put it in a spot where the noise is not going to bother you. And depending on the size of the machine, you need to have a dedicated outlet. The larger machines have to have their own separate outlet.
Wow. Okay, that's a big piece of equipment.
It's a big piece of equipment.
Yes.
Yeah.
But let's go to freezing.
Okay.
Now we've done freeze dry. Gosh, girls, we're getting down there. Okay, let's talk about freezing. That probably is the easiest of all, wouldn't you say?
Yes and no. Yeah. I don't know. Dehydrating is so easy to me.
Yes, it is.
So, but again, freezing, it's a lot of, as long as it's not canning, so many of these have similar aspects.
Yes.
And with freezing, you do want to blanch those vegetables. Mm-hmm. You can do some pre-treatments. If you are doing some different fruits, whether you're packing them in sugar or a syrup, really how you want to use them in the end is going to make a big difference. If you're wanting all your little fruits or pieces of vegetable to be independent of one another, you want to freeze them on a cookie sheet or something and then package them.
Yes.
Otherwise, I know I've a few times been in a hurry and just put all my stuff in my container, shoved it in the freezer, and then I just have a big giant frozen lump of raspberries or whatever it is. And then I can use it. I can still use it in certain things, but I can't easily measure out what I want or only use certain pieces. So definitely thinking of how you want to use that in the end is going to make a difference on how you freeze that.
And the one thing about blanching that people think, well, why do I have to blanch my veggies? They're just going in the freezer. But blanching stops some of the deterioration process. I think it's called senescence, just like your leaves change color in the changing of the season. And so vegetables, even in the freezer, will still deteriorate. And so blanching, that heat process of blanching, stops that process, if that makes sense.
Very important.
Yeah, you have to inactivate those enzymes by blanching.
And then, do you have to take all the oxygen out of freezing? Is that the best way to store them? Yes.
Yes. The more oxygen, the more chance you're going to have a freezer burn and just quality issues.
Mm-hmm.
The one nice thing about something from your freezer is, as long as it always stays frozen, it's good until the end of time. Let me rephrase that. It is safe.
There you go.
Until the end of time.
Because freezing will dry things out.
Yes.
So just note that.
Your quality, a lot of stuff. We've got charts in some of our publications and things that recommend how long you should freeze different things. Most stuff up to a year. So depending on if you packaged it properly. So it will always be safe. But yeah, you start running into some of those quality issues mm-hmm. where you might not really want to eat it once it's getting freezer burnt, dried out, some of those other, when you find that package that got stuck on the bottom of the freezer for 4 years and you somehow missed it, you're probably not going to want to eat it, but you could safely eat it if you had to.
If you were desperate.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
If you're desperate, and plus, the pressure cooker does redeem a lot of things like that.
Oh, it'll bring it. Yes.
Especially if it's been dried out. Yeah.
Sure. Sure. I just take my whole tomatoes and just put them in a bag and put them in the freezer, kind of squish them down a little bit and fill it up with the liquid. And then I have a whole batch that I don't even have to manage. I just stuff them in that bag and put them in the freezer.
Yeah. And that works for you.
It does. Mm-hmm. It really does work for me.
Well, and that's something to think about when you're canning and preserving things. Do things that work for you. If you have a big garden and you grow a lot of green beans and you decide to can them, but you don't like canned green beans, don't grow the darn things.
That's right. And really, you should be thinking about what you're going to do at the end. Like mm-hmm. Amy just said that. And Susie's been talking about how are you going to use it so that you do use it. It doesn't stay in your cupboard for 100 years.
Right, and yes. That's important.
Yes, yes it is. Well, we were going to talk about winter storage crops, but when these two gals came in, they said that is a whole 5-hour discussion. So real quickly, Amy, give us that book or that publication that you were talking about with all the information about winter storage.
Yes. So there is a great publication from the University of Idaho. It's called Harvesting and Storing Fresh Garden Vegetables. And Jennifer Jensen and I did a virtual class in July that pretty much covers a lot of what's in that publication. So if you were ever interested, you can contact myself or Jennifer at the Bonner County office and we can send you that recording, or we can help you find that publication. Unfortunately, right now, the University of Idaho is going through a major website remodel, and I don't think you can access the publications right now as the general public. However, we do have access as extension educators. So if there's a publication you're looking for, just get a hold of me and I can get that to you. But also there are a lot of other universities that we share publications. So there might be a publication on a different university website, even though you can't access it from ours currently.
Tell us your website, just so it's in our head how it works, because it's the University of Idaho.
Yes. So it's uidaho.edu, and it used to be /boundary/Bonner. And I believe that's going to be an option again once they finish the revamp. Right now it doesn't quite work, but you can go into the uidaho.edu and then in their little search bar put extension and you can find us. And soon we should have more information again, because each county has its own page. Yes. On that website. Yes. So you can see what types of programs we have. You can contact us. We do have newsletters that go out. I know we like to try to put all of our classes in the co-op roundup. So if you receive that, you can see which classes we have coming up. But yeah, going back to that harvesting and that storing, there's so many different, there's actually 5 different storage methods that we utilize. And each different type of vegetable kind of has its own unique percentage of humidity and temperature. And then how you prepare it. A lot of them, we just want you to shake off the dirt. We don't really want you to wash them. Some do better wrapped in brown paper bags. Some do better just exposed to air. Some you have to cure first. So it's really just dependent on which type of vegetable you're looking at.
And I found if you're looking for information about growing, you should really go to the extension offices to find that information, because there's all kinds of hacks out there that give you made up or false or just don't know what the gist is, and the extension offices all have websites.
Yes, there is a lot of misinformation online. Yes. And not just about gardening, but food preservation especially. Just because someone made a recipe once in their kitchen, they haven't died, they assume they can just put it online and encourage people to use it. And that's, well, I'm glad they're alive, but sometimes they're just lucky. So it's really, if you see some information and you're not sure, just contact your local extension office. Beyond teaching classes, a big part of our jobs is just answering questions from the general public and just helping you sift through that information.
And any classes you're having will be on the co-op roundup, because I think everyone gets that publication.
Yeah, most people.
Yeah, I think people it goes do. To,
and that's Boundary and Bonner County are both in there.
In most of the time, yes.
Most of the time. And the virtual classes are podcast?
They're webinars on Zoom.
Okay.
And then we do record them. And anyone who registers, whether or not you attend, we email you a link to that recording. We host it on an unlisted YouTube video.
And those are free.
They are free. Yeah. Yes. All of our webinars are always free.
There's always some interesting things going on there.
Yes.
And it's a good resource. It truly, truly is a good resource.
Yes. Can learn a lot. So anything else to add that we haven't gone through? We're running out of time. And finish up with any final thoughts.
Well, just think about safety. I mean, truly think about safety. And just because your great-grandmother did it doesn't mean that you can do it the exact same way. You can come up with something close.
Mm-hmm.
and your health is important.
Mm-hmm. And you'll see that bubbling if it's bad.
Oh, when you that's a good question. Okay. So when you pop off that seal, you should hear a whoosh sound. And you will, like if you turn a jar, you shouldn't do this, but if you turn a jar upside down and you put it back up, it's going to bubble because you've shifted it a little bit. But there's certain key factors that if you follow USDA, like headspace, that's the from the top of the jar to in the neck, and each food has a different headspace.
Okay.
Like jams and jellies, it's a quarter inch, which isn't much, but you still hear a little whoosh when you open up that mm-hmm. little jelly jar. And when after you've canned something, you should listen for the pop.
Yes. The seal.
The seal.
Yes.
Which is super important too.
And very exciting.
It count the seals. Yeah.
Amy, anything to add?
I think the biggest thing is just make sure you're always using an up-to-date approved resource. Because we're not saying that grandma did anything wrong. Because
nope.
when she was canning, that was their latest up-to-date information. And we know that research changes over time, recommendations change. So if you've got a ball book, make sure it's that new one. That's the 38th edition. Or look on the USDA website, the National Center for Home Food Preservation. That is a great website. It's based out of University of Georgia. They have tons of information. But again, never hesitate to contact your extension office. And if you really love food preservation and food safety and want to become an expert like Susie, I do teach the Master Food Safety Advisor class every April. And I'm the only one in the 10 northern counties that teaches this class. So while most of our volunteers are from Bonner, Boundary, or Kootenai County, we do have them as far away as Lewiston or Ruffino and Benoit, so St. Mary's. So if you're willing to come to Bonner's Ferry, we're happy to have you.
Is that like a 10-week class or 12 weeks?
It's 8 weeks.
8 weeks.
And there's hands-on labs and homework, and there is an open book test at the end. And then you spend the summer, you need to do 30 hours of volunteering.
Much like the Master Gardening
class.
It is.
They're basically the same. Just sure. One's on how do you grow the garden, the other's how do you preserve
it. Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Amy Robertson and Susie Miller, for coming in and talking about food safety and the fun way to save your harvest. We're going to, of course, have to play Homegrown Tomatoes by Guy Clark. So let's go to that. And thank you so much, Amy, for coming down from Bonner's Ferry, and Susie for coming down the street from Sandpoint. Appreciate having you both on.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.